Welcome to the AI Policy Podcast, a podcast by the Wadhwani Center for AI and Advanced Technologies at CSIS. I'm Gregory C. Allen.
And I'm Andrew Schwartz.
Join us as we dive into the world of AI policy, where we'll discuss the implications of this transformative technology for national security, geopolitics, and global governance. Welcome back to the AI Policy Podcast with me, Gregory C. Allen, and my co-host, Andrew Schwartz. Today, we've got Jim Rowan, the CEO of Volvo. Now, Volvo is a company with decades of experience in the automotive industry and now moving into the new world of AI, autonomous driving, and electric vehicles. And Jim Rowan is an interesting addition to the company because, except for the past 2 years as CEO, his principal background was in other sectors. And so we're really excited to have him here today. Thank you so much for coming, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, full disclosure, Jim, you know, we're on our second or third Audi in my family. Great cars, but we're here to talk about AI, and it's interesting. Tell us about your background. You're not the conventional car CEO.
No, I think that was one of the reasons. So if you look at the auto industry, it's gone through a profound change, and we tend to characterize that change by electrification. That's the kind of tag that we've given it. Quite honestly, the electrification part of the journey is pretty much done at this point in time. We know how to harness the electrical propulsion system. We know about batteries, we know about energy density, we know about electric motors, we know about inverter modules, we know about the battery management system that pulls all that together into a single EDU or electrical drive unit. And of course, that will progressively improve. We'll start to see energy density improve, we'll see costs coming down, we'll see different chemistries coming in. But the bigger and the much, much more profound change that's happened in the industry is about silicon, about software, about connectivity, and about data. And those are the big changes that if you don't understand those at a visceral level today, you're already in trouble as an auto manufacturer for the future. And that's what we've been investing in for the past 5 or 6 years. And my predecessor, you know, had the foresight to invest in that, I think, earlier than a lot of the heritage car companies. And now we're accelerating that at an incredible pace.
So a car company is really a technology company now.
Well, my full belief is that because there's so much technology that's coming in at the same time, you don't have the choice. You don't have the choice to say, hey, I'll just be good at this part. You need to be good at electrical propulsion and everything that goes with that. You need to understand high computational silicon, and more importantly, as we get forward, we'll talk about AI, but AI generative silicon, how that works. You got to be really good at software. And when I say software, there's multiple strands of software within the car now. You've got to be great at connectivity because everything's going to be connected, everything's going to be talking to each other, and you've got to be good at data collection, data management, and data analytics. If you can do that and you can bring all this together in the next couple of years, you will be positioned to be, I think, a dominant tech player.
Well, this is why we have Greg Allen at CSIS, to be a dominant tech player who really knows about AI. So I'm going to turn it over to Greg.
Well, I think it's really interesting what you said. It's not that every car company has to be a technology company, but it is that every car company has to be a tech company if they would like to survive. And I think that puts it in pretty well. So we're going to start the conversation around Volvo's efforts in AI and autonomy. And AI is one of the most hot topics in the entire global news ecosystem, not just the automotive ecosystem. But it's one where we've been hearing about it in cars for a very long time. Very famously, the CEO of Ford was predicting full self-driving autonomy. I think his time frame was 2021, and he was saying that back in 2016. So we're not at a world where full self-driving is very common, but we are at a world where increasing degrees of autonomy are common and more expected from more types of customers. So how does Volvo think about AI and autonomy, and in what areas of its business is it making the biggest impact right now?
Yeah, so if we take ADAS as a starting point, all the way up to full AD, right?
And just for the folks who might not have heard these terms before.
Okay. So ADS, which is assisted driving. So basically, mm-hmm. you're still in full control of the car, and the car is helping you to recognize there may be some dangers or so on. So assisted driving, let's call that, and then AD, full autonomous driving. When you're looking at that technology, then it's driven by two things, or three things. Basically, you need to understand the silicon, so the high computational silicon, how quickly can I process data? And then you need to be able to understand the application layer. So in the new EX90, which will start production in a couple of weeks' time, then there's 16 ultrasonic sensors, there's 8 cameras, there's 5 radar systems, and there's a LiDAR system, all standard in the car. That's a lot of tech that's seeing things around the car. So the ADAS stack, or the AD stack, the assisted driving stack, we write that ourselves. You can buy that. You can buy that from third parties if that's the choice that you make. We made a very, very conscious choice that we wanted to understand everything that the car sees. So we write the software from the silicon all the way up to the application layer.
So you talked about the silicon part of this story, which folks will remember a few years ago, there was a massive supply chain disruption brought on by COVID-19 and other factors, and the automotive industry was one of those that was most severely impacted.
Yeah, you couldn't get a car.
Yeah, literally.
You literally couldn't buy a car off the lot, and used cars were going for sometimes more than actual new cars.
Yeah, and so, you know, how did Volvo navigate that? I mean, everything that you just described, all of those sensors, all of those capabilities, the high-performance system powering any AI or autonomy features, all of that requires chips.
Yep, and so that, and part of the problem was the reason of that semiconductor situation was that the auto industry itself had outsourced a lot of that capability to third parties, effectively. So it used to be the way in which you built a car was you had a lot of this distributed architecture, so EDUs, so electrical units that would be driving different parts of the car, and these were done by third parties. Most of the car companies didn't have access to the silicon that was used in it or the code that was used in it. In fact, in a lot of cases, they didn't have a relationship with the end silicon manufacturers, whoever that may be. Now, as you move towards a core compute architecture, as we have in our new EX90, then you bring all of that or a lot of that into a centralized core compute. That means you don't have a choice but to have a fantastic relationship with that silicon supplier. And in our case, we're using NVIDIA and Qualcomm. So Qualcomm are on our cockpit and infotainment stack, and NVIDIA is on the core compute stack. We have very close relationships. Those are great companies, those are great partners, and we understand them. And they understand us, they understand our roadmap, where we want to go, we understand their roadmap and where they are taking their business. And so you have this very symbiotic and very close relationship, which goes out 3, 4, 5, 6, a decade into the future. That's very different from in the past, where you were buying in a black box, and you were positioning 130, 140 of these black boxes around the car, and they were talking to each other through a standard software set called AUTOSAR. It's just a completely different way in which to build a car. And in today's world, when you have that high computational silicon, when you have that choice of core compute architecture, the advantages it gives you are huge. And I guess we'll get into what are those advantages, because I guess that's going to be one of your questions. But
yeah, I wonder, what are those advantages? And having relationships like that with two major silicon companies has to be something that you're proud of.
So part of the transition to AI is deepening your relationship with the sort of critical semiconductor companies. What are the other parts of the transition that you've tried to make happen over these past 2 years and that you're working on right now?
Well, it's software, and it's software in various parts of the car. So we tend to, again, it tends to be, oh, we need software. It's like, oh, it's going to become the software-defined vehicle, and that's a homogenized term. There's a lot of strands of software. Let's be honest, if you do a download on your smartphone, and that download doesn't work quite properly, and it's buggy, let's say, and that's annoying. Yeah. You try and do that in a car, and the brakes don't work. That's disastrous.
Yeah.
So you've got very, very different software within the car. The mission critical software, the safety software. The companies like Volvo, we've been doing this for 97 years. We understand safety. We understand what it means to have redundancy in braking systems. We understand all this stuff at a pretty visceral level. And so you need to make sure then that the software that you build is robust, especially if you're moving to a new architecture. And then, of course, you've got the newer software, which is coming in, which is to do with connectivity, let's say. How do you connect to the iPhone so you can have a digital key and use your phone as a digital key, for example? How do you connect with the cloud? We have our own Volvo Cloud. In fact, we're operating a federated cloud system, so we're bringing in cloud information from various sources. We use some outsourced cloud architecture, and then we bring that into our own Volvo Cloud, and that connects constantly with a car.
Jim, I wonder, you're constantly trying to progress and get better and take advantage of the new technology, but when is it too fast, given that safety is really your priority?
Yeah, that's a great question, because let's then take that back to AD. We're building, and that's one of the reasons why we wanted to own the entire software stack. That's why we wanted to understand what is the perception software. So when you've got a LiDAR seeing something and a camera seeing something and a sensor seeing something, you need to make sure that software, all of that is coming together. And if the LiDAR is saying, I think that's a bike or a car or a tree or a deer, the cameras are going to, and this is going to happen like this, right? So you need to make sure you understand all of that code. But you also need to make sure that you can build it in a way which is progressive. And that's why we wanted to own it. So we will build AD AS, and let's talk about the levels a little bit. So you go up from level one through level five.
This is the autonomous driving framework that the National Highway Transportation and Safety Administration here in the United States uses, and it basically says zero is the human is doing absolutely everything in the driving of the car. Five is theoretically you could get in, fall asleep, and then arrive at your destination because the car is driven itself. And a lot of automotive manufacturers refer to this framework. The government refers to this framework. But I'm curious, you know, how does this framework, is it useful to you, or what do you think about when you're trying to go more autonomous?
Yeah, so for us, we look at it to the point of view whereby I think level five is a long way off. It will be allowed in certain very restricted jurisdictions in certain states and certain countries. So it's going to be governed as much by local legislation as it is by technology.
I could have really used it on the way to work this morning.
Yeah. And I think that's what will happen with the first place we'll see that is probably from downtown to the airports.
Yeah.
San Francisco would obviously be a logical place for that kind of stuff. But you're running through an urban area where you've got kids and bikes and skateboards and dogs and construction, and it changes every single day. Mm-hmm. Then that becomes that potentially becomes a much longer issue to solve, not from a technology point of view, but just from a governance and compliance point of view as much as anything else. So we look at it from the point of view as we're building our tech stack up, our autonomous or our AD tech stack. We're building it so that it will be able to give you AD in the areas that is allowable. But basically what we're really focused on right now is making the car as safe as it possibly can be for the driver at this point in time. So LiDAR is a great example. We put LiDAR in as a standard in the 90. And let me just talk about that technology. It's a wonderful technology, in my opinion, because it allows the car to see in the dark. It allows the car to do something that humans can't do at this point in time. And that's one of the big questions. Does this enable something which is better than a human can physically do? So if you look at LiDAR, and we're using the 1550 spectrum on LiDAR with Luminar, who we actually invested in as a company. We saw that technology, I'm going to say 5, 6, 7 years ago, and we got together with the guys at Luminar, liked what they were doing, liked the technology, and says, okay, let's make an investment through our tech fund. That tech is now in our car. So we get in really early on working with those guys and actually integrating that into our car as a standard technology. So LiDAR can see 200, 250 meters, pitch black, pitch dark. And what that means is at nighttime, unfortunately, a lot of serious accidents happen at nighttime. Why? Well, because people are tired. Visibility's left. People are not paying attention because the roads are less busy, you know? In some cases, you know, maybe people have had one or two drinks too many. There's a lot of reasons why at nighttime you get a lot of really serious accidents. And at nighttime, that's when one of the areas that LiDAR is really progressive in, and it can see 250 meters. If you're driving in the car, even if you're fully alert and fully awake, you can see the length of your headlights.
Right.
It's like, what, 50, 60 meters?
Right, you're not seeing 250.
You don't see 250. And the car sees 250 and it says, there's something out there. We're writing the software. We know it's a dog or a bike or a child or a car. And it doesn't take control of the car, but it starts to rumble you and say, hey, listen, you start to slow the car down. And so those benefits to ADAS, I think, are tremendous. And I think we'll save, you know, or we'll avoid a lot of accidents in the future. And that's why we put it in a standard.
When you think about 250 meters, an Olympic-sized swimming pool is 50 meters. So multiply that. That's a long way to be able to see ahead.
It's a lot. So if I make the math easy on that and you say, okay, if you're traveling at 60 kilometers an hour, right, that's or 120 kilometers an hour, it's going to give you 8 seconds somewhere in that
region.
That's
incredible.
Right? More than you would if you would see just in your headlights.
And is it seeing wide also, or is it just seeing, you know?
Yeah, so the system that we have sweeps across 120 degree radius. So it sweeps from side to side. So it's designed to cover the edges of the roads as well. So you can see as it sweeps across that 120 radius.
This is the future, Greg.
Well, I think LiDAR is really exciting, but it also sort of highlights a decision you've made strategically as a company. You mentioned how you're vertically integrated when it comes to the autonomy software stack, and you've made a bet on LiDAR, and you sort of stand in contrast to one of the other car companies in the field, Tesla. Tesla, which very famously is relying almost entirely on just electro-optical regular cameras and AI-based processing of those images, and is also promising autonomous driving is next year, every year for the past 5 years, and yet we're still not exactly there. And so I'm curious, you know, what sort of accounts for that sort of strategic decision? Because you are a partner with Tesla in some areas, like the supercharger network, but you're not a partner in autonomous driving. And what sort of accounts for that?
Yeah, we're not a partner in terms of the supercharger. We have access to that supercharger network, which I think was meaningful for our customers because that was something which I think enables our customers to have more charging points and more fast charging points. So that was
access to this existing infrastructure.
Exactly.
Right.
And as I think the Inflation Reduction Act will allow that to expand and high-speed infrastructure to expand. But we want people to be able to get access to that right now. Mm-hmm. And as it unfolds, I think that will become less of a problem in the future. We can talk about what I think are the four friction factors to full EV adoption if we get a chance to.
No, I really want to do that because I want to come back to that. One of the things that obviously everyone's talking about is access to charging.
Yeah.
You know, we can't drive from Washington to New York to Boston without knowing where the chargers are. So that's really important.
Yeah. And that's why I think our technology, and that's why I think we're in a really good position. Our job is to make every car that we build as safe as possible, whether that's an ICE car, internal combustion car, whether that's a PHEV, a plug-in electric hybrid, or a full BEV. And the ADAS stack that we're developing will run across all of that. So back to your question, why did we make that choice? We made the choice quite simply is because we're not chasing this full AD piece because we think it's important that the progressive safety of the car with the technology that we've got right now in a progressive staged approach is for us, it's a choice that we've made as a safety brand, and we've been a safety brand for 100 years, is a lot more meaningful to our customers than trying to get to full AD at this point in time when there's a lot of barriers to get to that full AD. But you need to build the tech stack differently if you're going to go progressively towards AD, and that's basically what we've chosen to do.
Ah, okay, so you're really optimizing for this progression kind of phenomenon. Now, one of the things that you had said earlier was the driving factor behind this progression is the different kind of regulatory environments. And so here we are on the AI policy podcast. I want to sort of ask where we are in terms of the regulation environment for autonomous driving. And I'm curious if you could sort of map this in global terms, because Volvo is, you know, selling its cars in multiple regions around the world. So what does the regulatory landscape look like for autonomous driving, and is it keeping up with the pace of technological progress?
Well, as you can imagine, it's really different in different jurisdictions. When you're a global car company and you're trying to make sure that you can build a car which is global and homologate that car in all the different regions of the world and satisfy all those different customers, we're bringing in a younger demographic. The EX30, or small SUV that we just launched, is bringing in much younger people. Mm-hmm. So now we're going from, 17-year-olds to 70-year-olds.
The point of entry has changed
completely. And then some people want to subscribe to the car. They don't want to own the car any longer. So how can we get those customers satisfied? So we offer subscription-based ownership to our customers as well. But we're going from Tokyo to Tallahassee.
Yeah.
I mean, and everywhere, and Timbuktu is probably in the middle of that. So, so you've got to cater for all of those different demographics, all of those different road traffic. And even here in the US, you get the Department of Transport, you get NHTSA, you've got lots of different, you've got the Environmental Protection Agency. All of those people work together and they have different regulations. And we need to make sure that we cover all of those, not just on the AD stack, but also on all the other emissions stack and everything
else.
Not to mention made in America, exactly. The EX90 incident, I'm glad you said that, because the EX90 will start its production life in our Charleston facility.
That's great.
First time ever, actually, which is interesting. First time ever that we've manufactured a brand new model on a brand new platform outside of Europe.
Well, you're in Washington, D.C. this week. I'm sure that's a message that you're carrying forward in all of your meetings with the various government agencies. Yeah, they love to hear.
Yeah, because we've been here 70 years. We've been selling cars in the U.S. for 70 years.
Yeah, right? My brother's first car was a Volvo.
Yeah, so I think we're navigating that. I think, I mean, it's a wide question. It's a great question. And I'd love to have a really sharp answer for you to say this is exactly how we're managing the AD adoption, and this is exactly how we're building our AD stack in every single city in the world. But it is complex, and we're navigating that, I think, as well as anybody else, partly because we chose to make the investment to do the software. Just on that software stack, just on the safety stack, so just writing the software from the silicon to the safety application layer of cameras and sensors and LiDARs and so on, we have 800 software engineers just doing that. That's a big investment.
It really is.
There's some jurisdictions in the United States that have pretty lax regulations because they're trying to encourage testing and early adoption. You know, Arizona, San Francisco come to mind. Do these types of regions that are more open to early stage autonomous driving technologies, are they useful to you as a company?
I think they're useful to the industry in general because those places allow you to do some of the real-world trials, and it allows you to get those cars out there and try. You need to do that in a really controlled and safe environment, of course, but it does, I think, if you've got jurisdictions that allow you. And there's other places around the world as well which are now opening up certain areas that you can test fully autonomous cars in a real-world environment. We're lucky we have our own proving grounds in Volvo in Sweden. It's a huge area that we've had for, I think, 50, 60 years. And it's like a city within a city. So we're lucky in that we have the wherewithal to do a lot of those testings under simulated city environments, simulated country environments, simulated urban environments of different natures. And we can set that up. But not every car company has that capability. And so I think for some of maybe the younger car companies that don't have access to that, being able to have access to that in a real-world environment is probably more helpful to them than it is probably to us.
You know, Jim, at CSIS, we research extensively the intersection of advanced technologies like AI and with geopolitics. How does the relationship between those two things figure into your strategy at Volvo?
Again, it's one of the things which is making life a little bit more complicated right now. So there's three or four things, you know, that... I was lucky enough to get to the World Economic Forum this year in Davos, and I came away from that with things which basically I designated into four Ds plus a fifth D.
Okay. Right?
If I can term it like that. And the four Ds were decoupling. So we're starting to see some supply chains decouple, you know, between East and West. So that's very clear. We're seeing disruption. We're seeing disruption in a lot of ways. Of course, the Red Sea. We're seeing disruption. That's an election year in the US. That always causes some troubles. We're seeing the European Union now look at extra tariffs for electric cars coming in from China. So we're starting to see that decoupling. Decarbonization, it's clear it's present, but the flavor of that, the speed of that is changing. And that's partly that is to do with energy security. And it's great if we can get to a fully electric future, but we're going to need the energy in order to serve that. So those two things are happening at the same time. And then we have digital and AI. I put the two of those together. We have a lot of ML and machine learning capabilities within our company. And of course, we have our own data centers. Because we get the data, we have our own data centers to crunch that data and then layer on top of that full AI. So that's the four: decoupling, you know, decarbonization, and so on. And that leads to a fifth D, which is basically design. How do you design cars for the future? How do you design your supply chain for the future? How do you design your business models for the future? If you can only sell cars in certain parts of the world that have got this technology and cars that have a slightly different technology in that part of the world, how do you design all of that stuff? And so it's really a moment in time, I think, for the entire industry as we go through this massive transition. So anyway, that was my takeaway from Davos. I don't know whether that makes sense, but it's how I look at the kind of global, not just for the auto industry, but I think a lot of industries are suffering the same kind of 5D effect, let's say.
So let's drill into one aspect of the geopolitical situation that is, of course, something that you have to wrestle with, which is U.S.-China relations. And so they've become increasingly competitive, increasingly adversarial in recent years. And the majority shareholder of Volvo Cars is Geely, which is a Chinese company. And China is also one of your largest customer markets. So while Volvo has this long history as a Swedish and a European car manufacturer, you know, you have a lot of global ties, including a lot of ties to China. So how does the current state of the U.S.-China relationship affect your overall thinking when it comes to AI and other advanced technologies?
Yeah, and you're right. So we have high ownership. But we took the company public. So we're actually a public company. We listed in the NASDAQ in Stockholm. So we're governed and guided by the rules and regulations of a European company that is a public European company that's listed in Stockholm or on the NASDAQ in Stockholm. And yes, we have high ownership from Geely. We also have an independent board. So I think we're in the position whereby we're a global company and we get the benefits of really understanding the Chinese market. It's a big market for us. It's a big market for many global car manufacturers. So we understand that, I think, because we have good relationships with the Geely Group and the supply chains around that. So that's really helped us. It's helped us to take out costs. It's helped us to understand that market in a much better way. And then at the same time, we have 97 years of history being a Swedish company. We started in Gothenburg in 1927. As I say, we've been in the US for 70 years as well. So we're in a kind of a good position, I think, in that we understand East and West. We know how the importance and the factors. We also know what customers are looking for in China versus many of the countries in the West. And that's quite profoundly changed as well in the last couple of years. And so, again, I think we navigate through all of those turbulent waters, or can be turbulent waters, in a pretty decent way because we understand it.
How big is your business in China versus here in the United States?
If you take it as a country, then China is still our single biggest market.
By share of revenue?
By share of revenue. In the US, the US would be second biggest market.
What about in terms of production?
So you used to have the 301 bill, if you guys are familiar
sure,
with that.
Course.
So it used to be 2.5% if you manufacture a car in China and import it to the USA. That increased by 25% 4 or 5 years ago.
This is a tariff on importing a car manufactured in China.
So that took it to 27.5%. You know, and if you were paying attention at that point in time, then you'd say, okay, we need to start looking at how do we design our supply chains going forward. So we started a process about 5 years ago. So again, predates me. I'd love to take credit for it, but my predecessor was the guy who put that in place. And basically what they said is, like, we want to make what we source and source what we make. So we started a kind of regional manufacturing. That's why we're expanding. That's one of the reasons why we're expanding in Charleston, right? But we've also expanded in Europe as well. So we have manufacturing locations in Asia, we have manufacturing locations in Europe, and we have manufacturing locations in the US. And the goal as we go forward, back to the decoupling, de-risking, and some of the turbulence that we're seeing, we think going forward, you're probably gonna have to have a large percentage. It's not 100% game. It's not a game of absolutes. But you need to, because everything keeps changing, of course, right? Yeah. But it's a game whereby you need to understand, I think the direction of travel is going to be more than less. Mm. So let's get a regional manufacturing operation. Let's get regional suppliers. Let's get regional customers in those cars so that we don't get snarled up in the gears of tax tariffs or import bans or technology bans for that matter.
And let's take that to a few of the topics that you've already mentioned. You've talked about LiDAR technology. You've talked about high-performance semiconductors for AI, such as the ones that NVIDIA makes, you know, both of which have been really hot topics in U.S. politics. There's discussions about restricting sales of Chinese-made LiDAR systems. In October 2022, the United States restricted the sales of high-performance AI chips to China. How does that affect your business?
Well, it doesn't right now, right? But again, it goes back to what's your future field of vision, and what do you think things are going to go? I mean, these things are going to look really obvious in 5 years' time from now, but you need to make decisions now. And when you're setting up a manufacturing facility, that's a couple of $1 billion investment that you're making 3-4 years from now.
Yeah.
And you hope you get it right. So it's complex and it's changing. And so we look at the data sets, we look at that, and then we make a decision. If it comes that there is a technology embargo on certain parts, then you're going to have a supply chain where you use this chipset or this LiDAR manufacturer for this part of the world, and you use that LiDAR manufacturer for that part of the world. You're just going to have to deal with that. It's going to be a level playing field because everybody's going to be in the same boat. So I don't know that that's a debilitator in that sense. You just got to be paying attention that you're designing your supply chain. It used to be that everybody was designing the supply chain for just-in-time manufacture.
Right.
Building it, you ship to the West. That changed a long time ago, not just in the last 5 years when 301 came in, but it changed for a lot of industries a long time ago. And so the robustness now is really the name of the game. And you need more than one supplier, and you probably need two different suppliers if you can get them. But even if you get the same supplier, you want to make sure you've got that in at least two parts of the world.
What goes into a decision to manufacture in Charleston? Why Charleston? Other than the beauty and the restaurants and, you know, why Charleston?
Yeah, so we did an analysis that we set up that factory in 2018. I wasn't in the company at that point in time, but I would ascertain, I could, from the information that I've learned so far, is that we looked at various places. We wanted to manufacture in the US. We wanted to be close to the customers. Logistics costs are high when you manufacture and ship big units like cars across the world. The latency in terms of getting that into the hands of the customers. So there was a lot of time benefits to that. There was a lot of cost benefits to that in terms of logistics costs. And even though it may be cheaper to build in the East and ship to the West, you've got to take into account the weighted average cost of capital and 8 or 9 weeks on the water and how quickly you can get those cars to the hands of the customer and how quickly you can make changes at the last minute in the production line and so on and so forth. And then that got you to, okay, we want to be in the US, so where do we want to be in the US? And I guess we looked at everywhere as the same as most other people came, and quite a few people have chosen South Carolina. It's a great place in terms of working with the local authorities there has been tremendously beneficial to us. They really understand business in a way. They understand our needs, and we work, you know, really well with the, and we got to know South Carolina in that respect before we made that final decision. And it's been a great decision for us.
Let's talk about the EX30 again. Last year, you described your company's decision to add the new EX30 model to production facilities in Europe as a natural hedge against geopolitical changes. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
Yep. So right now, that car started its production life in one of our factories in China. This is a small, what we call city car. We think it's a perfect car for the adoption to electrification. 480 kilometers. I'm going to guess that's 300 miles or 280 miles or so.
In one charge.
That's a $35,000 car. So we want to democratize electrification for people who want to drive in a safe car like a Volvo.
So you can get a Volvo for $35,000 that goes 300 miles in one charge.
Yeah, I think it's 280, but yeah, close, wow. Near as damn. You got a lot of technology in that car as well. So we had manufactured that car starting in China, and that's fine. Right now the tariffs, if you move from China and you ship a car into Europe, it's 10%. Right now it's 27% of obviously in the US.
Much higher here.
Yeah, so it's 2% if you move a car from Europe into the US. So we have a manufacturing facility in Belgium, which had some capacity. It made sense for us to say, let's dual manufacture that product. We'd done this at the design, we just started in China, and then we'll start. In fact, this year, we'll hopefully be doing a lot of the groundwork to make sure we can manufacture that car in Europe. And that allows us then to manufacture that car and sell it in Europe, but it also allows us to sell that car in the US without attracting those high tax tariffs.
So in addition to the cost of the tariffs, you had mentioned that your relationship with Geely and your other Chinese partners, suppliers, shareholders had really helped you to take out some of the cost. So can you just sort of elaborate, what are the sources of the cost competitiveness aspect of this story?
Well, part of it is just leverage. If you look at the volume that we produce, and you talk to a supplier and you do negotiations with a supplier with just our volumes versus the volumes of the entire Geely group, then you get leverage and you get suppliers that want to buy in a bit tighter, who lean in a little bit more. So it's one of scale and it's one of leverage. So you get the economies of scale, but you also get the economies of scope. And I think that's those two things combined are meaningful. I mean, the industry is a tough industry. It's competitive. And right now, the industry is, I would say, going through a hyper-competitive phase. Partly because you've got a lot of new Chinese manufacturers coming in. But if that's even isolated to China, it's also hyper-competitive right now because people are trying to take market share in BEV. The Western companies are trying to take market share in BEV because they're being rewarded if they're seen to be a BEV company and that they understand the new technologies.
And so that $35,000 price tag for a really long-range electric vehicle with a lot of technological bells and whistles, that takes into account the cost of the tariff.
When we start manufacturing this car here.
Yeah, other...
But we'll start shipping that car probably from the Ghent facility.
Oh, okay.
And great. By the way, you don't get the 280, I think, is a long-range battery, so I want to be full disclosure that it comes in two battery sizes. The $35,000 may be the shorter battery size, so...
Not every CEO would have clarified that, yeah, so I respect you for actually being transparent in the cost and the pricing.
Well, Jim, can you tell us a little bit about Chinese EV companies in general and what they mean for the United States EV industry?
So here's my perception on it, is that... If you're sitting, so this is why we've been bold and we've moved and we've said, listen, we have really good internal combustion cars. We've been selling them for almost 100 years. We've got really good PHEV cars. I'm an engineer. I look at the technology. And when you look at the underlying technology of electrical propulsion, yes, there's issues in terms of infrastructure. So let's go into the four friction factors, because this is probably a good place to put that in. That's the four friction factors I see towards full-scale adoption of EV is cost. So we need to get the battery cost down. Is range. We need to get energy density up. Mm-hmm. Three, we need to get charging speed down. Right? So we move to 800.
It takes forever in some cases. Unless you go to a high-speed charger, you're there for hours.
And then the fourth one is exactly that, which is infrastructure. Right? So I think we as automotive companies or as technology companies, we own the first three. We need to get the cost out. We need to get the energy density up. And we need to get the speed of charging up, let's say, right? The fourth one And this is why the Inflation Reduction Act, I think, is important. Infrastructure, that's going to be massively helpful. And where I think a lot of countries around the world have made the mistake is they say, we've got 20,000, 50,000, 100,000 chargers. Yeah, they went for slow chargers. They went for 22 kilowatt chargers. That's fine if it's at your home and you charge overnight. That's perfect. And you're bringing in a 30 amp supply, you can get 22 kilowatts of charge. Perfect. 6 hours, you're done. You're sleeping. You don't care. But when you get public charging, you need to be at least 150, probably better if you're 250. Then you get that speed. When we move our cars to an 800 volt system, which we will next year, then that charging speed goes way up. So if you're on a fast charger, you can then put in 200 kilometers of range in 5.5 minutes.
That's incredible.
And that's here right now, right? Provided you have a fast charge and provided you have an 800 volt system or a decent system that can absorb that, and you've done the proper work on power electronics within your vehicle to make sure that you don't overheat the batteries and all that stuff, then that is doable. And that will only progress.
Yeah, this is moving so fast.
So it's only going to progress. And this is the big thing. So when I look at the technology and I say, okay, for the energy that you put in to an internal combustion engine, a really well-tuned engine, to the propulsion that you get for the movement forward, right? And that's, you got to take, you lose energy on heat, you lose energy on vibration, you lose energy on noise. And that means that a really well-built internal combustion engine is probably 35% efficient to the fuel you get in, to the movement that you get forward. On the new EDU, the new electrical propulsion systems you've got, on a really well-tuned, that'll be north of 90%. You don't need to be a data scientist to figure out that's pretty profound.
Absolutely.
Right. And the other thing as well is when you use oil, or a gallon of oil, you use it, you burn it, it's gone. As you go forward, when you put batteries in a car and you use that up to its end of life, let's say whatever, 10, 12 years, you can recycle that. You can get the precious metals back. We're starting to see companies like Redwood now really invest heavily in this in different parts of the world. And I think that it doesn't disappear into the ether. You can harvest that, urban mining or whatever you want to call it. And that's going to become another big part of the recycling and the circularity of electric vehicles. It's a long time in the future. That's not going to happen overnight either. And then this is part of the problem. The narrative is when. It's going to be a while, guys, but technology moves in stages. And you need to be prepared to make the investments now to reap the benefits. And it looks like this thing's going to go linear, and it's never linear, right?
Right.
It goes linear for a while, then you go into an S-curve or a double S-curve, and eventually you get there. But there's a reason why we've all got smartphones rather than a desk phone. Right? Technology wins the day. And I think this is akin to us moving from steam to internal combustion to electrification. I think it's that's the...
That profound.
That profound. And then there'll be something else. Somebody will figure out something that takes it to a whole new level. But for the next while, our best bet is electrification.
And you know, this country is nuts about cars, and we're nuts about smartphones. So I guess the big bet is that we, you know, you turn your car into more of a smartphone, and then you really have something.
Yeah, well, I think you're seeing the connectivity part now. I mean, let's be honest. This is the real change that's happening. I've 4 kids, right? And I talk to each one of my kids on a different channel. So I'm like WhatsApp with one, and Snap and another, and Instagram. And
you're a good dad for doing that.
Yeah, it's been a learning process, let me tell you. But but the thing about that is that as young people come into new vehicles, their expectation levels are different. If I'm listening to Spotify in my phone and at home, and I'm going to the gym, and I say, okay, I'm going to, so I grab my phone and I get into the car, and the same song starts playing in Spotify in the car, I'm still like, hey, that's pretty cool. My kids are like, that's table stakes, you know. So
I love how you managed to work in a compliment to another proud Scandinavian heritage company.
Well, they are. Yeah. Listen, I'm a huge user of Spotify. Great company.
Yeah.
So, but that's it. And of course, that's the thinking that you've got to have. You've got to think, what's this going to look like in 5 years' time when you really have that full adoption?
Because digitization. It's a good point. What we think is cool, the kids, you know, take for granted. Yeah. They're digital natives. They expect this stuff. Yeah.
And so you had the buzzword that's digital natives. I mean, we are, maybe some of you guys are probably not, but some, I'm pretty good at it, but I was born analog. Yeah. I can convert, but there's a lag.
That's right.
I think analog, I convert to digital. They think digital.
They do.
And they don't even bother converting to analog because they don't need to.
They don't even know what it is or want to know what it is.
And that's who we're building cars for, not just for our existing customer base, which we hope, of course. And even we find our existing customer base, they really like the new technologies that they get. So when you think about electrification, yes, you get all this fantastic drive capability, but you also get the new connectivity of the car as well. You know, and very shortly, I spoke about this publicly, so I speak about it here. It goes back to the AI conversation, I think, which is important. When we have those 8 cameras and the LiDAR systems and all that, the car is going to see a lot. So there's companies that we're working with right now, big companies that we're working with right now, cloud-based architecture companies that we're working with. And basically, as the car rolls off, as the EX90 rolls off, and this is not happening for the first launch, but this is something that we're very seriously working on now. As it rolls off physically the production line, a digital twin is born in the Volvo cloud of that car for the entire life of that car. It sees everything. It knows when it's been charged, if it's been overcharged or undercharged. It knows when it's been using petrol versus when it's been using electric, or if it's just a full electric car, the speed of charge, and you have a whole history. You can choose to turn it off. You don't need to have that if you don't want it. But if you do want that, you're going to have this real-time history of the car. Why is that important? Well, we'll be able to see if that car's been repaired with genuine Volvo parts at genuine Volvo dealerships. We'll be able to see if the car's been stressed, if it's been in an accident. All that stuff will be, because if it's been in an accident, all the sensors are going to tell you that. It's going to be captured in the cloud. And we'll also, through our battery algorithms, we'll be able to see how good those batteries are. So when you come to sell that car in the secondhand market, you'll be able to look at that digital twin, take information and say, it's a pretty nice car. And we as Volvo say, we know this, and our algorithms will tell you, we'll guarantee those batteries for another 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So that helps with residuals. And people don't even, you can't do that in a nice car. You can't layer AI on top of a nice car. And that's the big, profound change that I'm talking about as a technologist, as opposed to an automotive executive. That's what it's headed.
Because you really need that digital twin and that data stream to sort of inform the future AI work of the company.
And then you take that back to, okay, you only get that data if you write your software that connects your core computer architecture, your high computational silicon, with a LiDAR set, with a data set, with a camera set. And if you're writing that software, you see what the car sees. If you use a third party, you don't see it. They don't give you the data. Your car's running around. They see it. You don't.
What percent of your users are opting for the digital twin?
Well, right now, that's for us. I just started talking about that because I think it's an important message. So we haven't got that technology harnessed yet, but we're working heavily on it. I spoke about it publicly, so it's stuff that I've spoken about publicly before.
So let me rephrase it. What usage do you expect?
Oh, very, very high usage. I mean, you think about this. You're buying a car which is $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 in purchase. Right, you're going to opt in, probably much higher than you would on other products. You want to know what's happening in the car. You want to know if it needs to be repaired. You want to know, you know, and if you can get that smartly driven to your iPhone, you get that update every month. Hey, this month you drove 420 miles at an average of 50 miles per gallon or per charge, or your kids use the car. You'll see who else is in the car. Your kids use the car. Take even car sharing, right? So you go to a car share and say, hey, listen, I don't want to own a car. I can't really afford it. Let's club together, guys, and we'll share a car together. But it's only fair that if you're using it 50% of the time, you pay 50% of the bill, right? So let's everybody opt in, and we'll put in our credit card numbers into our joint car ownership app. And then when you drive, you know, and by the way, let's say your insurance is a bit better. So this is the other thing that you can offer, insurance. Insurance right now, think about insurance. Just take that as an example. You pay your insurance whether you're in the car or whether you're not in the car. Whether you drive 100 hours a week or 1,000 hours a week, you pay the same insurance. But it stands to reason that you're going to be in a crash probably more often, or be in some kind of event if you drive the car more than, especially if you drive at times of high traffic. So you pay insurance not based on how good a driver you are, how safe a driver you are. You base it based on your age and if you've had an accident before, and maybe your zip code because you stay in a nice neighborhood, so the car's not going to get stolen. Right? Flip that whole thing on its head and you say, okay, if I see everything, if you want to opt in and say, listen, we can tell how you drive the car that you're a safe driver.
So people can learn an enormous amount more about their cars than they can now with this. And you, the car company, can learn more, which Greg was saying before, to the AI point, that's going to help inform your AI going forward.
Of course, and it's a benefit to the customer because we're focused in on making the car safer and providing services for our customers. I don't think you can charge your customer every time you do a software update. I don't subscribe to that. If Apple charged me every time I got an iPhone update, I would be pretty annoyed. They don't, right?
Yeah.
I don't think you can do that. I don't think you can charge for heated seats and stuff. I don't think that works. I think what you can do is meaningful benefits to the customer. So I'll come back to the insurance piece. So you're driving, you say, hey, listen, would you like to have Volvo insurance? If you want to opt in on that, we can say, you drive the car for a bit and we say you're an 87% driver. You're a 42% driver, based on our algorithms, how close you come to parked cars, how quickly you accelerate, whether you stop at the stop signs for the proper amount of time, all that stuff. It's simple. This is not hard software to write. And then you can say, okay, now you, because you're a safe driver, should pay less. You can make that an available. You could make that hourly.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would want my car knowing how close I come to other parked cars, but I get the point.
But you can't. But the point to that is, what does it enable?
Yeah.
You know, whether customers choose to take up on that or whether they don't, it's a choice. But if we give that choice to the customers, and some customers saying, yeah, you know what, I have an 18-year-old, the insurance is crazy. And for that 18-year-old, who may be a really good driver.
And you can then show that.
You can show that and we'd insure it. Right?
I'm fascinated by all this, and my corporate strategy and MBA background is really loving this sort of new insurance model you're talking about. But I do want to bring the conversation back to geopolitics, recognizing that you're in Washington and there's some big debates going on right now. So on February 29th, the White House announced that the United States was opening an investigation into whether Chinese vehicle imports pose national security risks. And in November 2023, a bipartisan group of U.S. lawmakers raised alarms about Chinese companies collecting and handling sensitive data while testing autonomous vehicles in the United States. So you've talked about this sort of digital twin future, this data-driven future. Folks in the United States are sort of connecting that to a national security. And China is doing the same, of course. Tesla vehicles are now no longer allowed near certain government institutions, partly because of this sort of data collection story. So how do you think about, you know, these types of debates, and what is your sort of message to the policymakers of Washington in these debates?
Well, I don't have a message to the policymakers. They've got to do their job the same as we've got to do our job, right? And we'll comply to the rules and regulations and how that comes out. And if that means that we're not allowed to use a Chinese LiDAR maker in cars in the US, we'll figure it out. That's what we're paid for. And we'll find a local manufacturer that can do that and comply to the rules and regulations. Mm-hmm. If it means that as you're driving along and you need to turn off the data capture in certain geo-tagged places, we'll turn it off. You know, we've got the technology to do that. So, but the policymakers will make the policies and we'll conform to those policies. I think we have enough engineering talent that we will figure that out pretty quickly. And when they make those decisions, we'll comply with those decisions. It's the same as when decisions have been made about environmental and you need to now conform to certain particulate matters, or you need to conform to certain other rules and regulations. We've figured all of that out for 100 years. So I think we're going through a new phase just because everything's becoming connected. Mm-hmm. We're starting to figure that out. That may mean that we need to do this, this, and this. And if you're a car company like us that's been around for a while and you've got that talent, and you know how to do it quickly, and you understand what homologation means and how to homologate cars properly and what the regulations and the authorities, then we'll get through it.
And then what about on the EU side of the equation? Because the EU has opened an anti-dumping investigation into the Chinese electric vehicle industry, sort of arguing that the real price is not an honest price because of all the subsidies that have taken into account, which is in violation of certain types of trade agreements. How does this affect you as Volvo, and what are you thinking about this specific policy?
Yeah, so that's still in the making. So we'll see where the European Union come out. I think they'll probably make a decision on that reasonably quickly. Mm-hmm. And right now there's a tariff of 10% if you import a car from China to the US. Of course, the question is whether that increases.
10% to the EU.
10% to the EU, yeah. And the same backwards into China from Europe. So if they decide that there's been subsidies and they want to increase the tax tariffs, again, the European Union, they'll make that decision and we'll need to live with it. We're way down the stream in terms of we're already set up with a supply chain which is pretty resilient. We have two manufacturing plants in Europe. We're building a third manufacturing plant in Europe. We have pretty much a full supply chain in Europe as well. I mean, it's a robust and it's a well established supply chain because all the car manufacturers in Europe anyway. So that particular thing won't really affect us. I think it'll affect other people.
Yeah, I mean, the Mercedes-Benz CEO just recently basically said to Europe, don't do it. And sort of a different message from the one you're sharing here today.
Yeah, because we are, you know, I think we're further along that make what you sell and source what you make strategy. So we've already taken some.
You've sort of already got the supply chain closer to what you would want in that future.
Yeah. And remember, we've had the Tosh Lande plant for 97 years. We've had the Ghent plant for 60 years. So we've built up a good supply chain around them. We're just building a new factory in Slovakia. Mm-hmm. And so we can actually we can harvest off the existing suppliers in Europe to actually feed the Slovakia factory as well.
You know, I wonder about something you were saying before. As you described how you're going to comply with whatever regulations and rules come from the United States, it was very businesslike and matter of fact, as you would if you're a CEO. But what do you think about the collision? There's a lot of emotions in the United States about AI, about China, about data, all these things. And that's going to be reflected in our policymakers. How do you deal with something like that?
Well, I think that what the policymakers will do will be say, this is what you're allowed to do with that data. This is how you're allowed to capture that data. This is where you're allowed to store this data. This is what you need in order to have customers to know that that data is being captured. So they've got to opt in. You've got to make it visible. You've got to make it easy for them to stand. You've got to make sure that you store that data properly and you don't violate any of these rules. Remember, we came through this in Europe. We have a system that was put in place in Europe about 4 years ago called GDPR. Mm-hmm. A very comprehensive data usage and data protection.
The landmark European privacy legislation. Yeah. Right.
So we've dealt with that for the last 4 years. And obviously, when that came in, there was a lot of learning that came into that really quickly. We figured it out. And I think it'll be exactly the same here as those data regulations change. But remember as well, we're a European company. We're guided by GDPR. So we're already compliant to all the GDPR rules in Europe. And it's pretty punitive. You get that wrong, it's going to cost you money. So people are paying attention to that. And I think as a European company that's gone through that, I think we understand the data protection and data management part reasonably well. There'll be some nuances, of course, here in the US and elsewhere, but we deal with the data protections in Japan, in Korea, in China, in every country that we sell. I think we sell in 80 countries or something like that. So most of them are quite similar, but you always have the little nuances that you need to figure out. And I think it will be the same here in the US.
So you've talked about the areas of policy where you're leaving it to the policymakers to sort of find their own way. Is there an area where there is something you would like to see change in Washington or in Brussels or in Beijing? Is there a sort of policy that you're hoping that the United States will invest in or change?
You know, I think the adoption of helping to have new technologies for a lot of different reasons. As I said before, this is not something that's going to happen overnight. So we need to be mindful of customers who want to have and feel comfortable still being able to drive an internal combustion car or a plug-in electric hybrid. What we see is the plug-in electric hybrid is a fantastic bridge to full electrification. And we see it more and more. People who buy a plug-in electric hybrid, they get to know the technology. When they buy the next car, even if it's a car for their kids or another car for themselves, then they buy BEV. They buy a full electric car. Not in every case, but in a high percentage of cases. You can't leapfrog it. You can't say, I'm just going to have internal combustion until as late as possible and then do a leapfrog into full BEV. You've got to go through the learning process.
You need to build this bridge now.
You've got to invest in the future so that you understand how, and you build up the supply chain and you build up the relationships as we've done with NVIDIA and as we've done with Qualcomm, as we've done with battery suppliers and so on. You've got to start that journey now. And you can't just do an immediate pivot to, you'll be left behind. And I think it's good that we're starting to see incentives in the US that is encouraging investment and development on new technologies. Mm. Even if...
Like the Inflation Reduction Act or other things? Yeah.
And even if you see that not everybody's ready to make the EV transition at this particular point in time, don't be fooled by that will never be the case.
Jim, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you for coming here and sharing some of your thoughts with us here at CSIS. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the AI Policy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And don't forget to visit our website, csis.org, for show notes and our research reports. See you next time.